I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, the conversation about race is on. Is it good for the presidential candidates, the Democratic Party, the country? But first, Congress is gearing up for 2008, the House returning to work tomorrow, the Senate next week. The word recession was batted about quite a bit while they were away. Will Republicans and Democrats uphold the vow they made before the holidays to work together? Joining us for a look at this second act, Gail Chadha, Capitol Hill correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Gail, let's tick through some of the items left over from last year, starting with President Bush's veto of a defense bill, the White House objecting to that provision that they saw as an opening for lawsuits against the Iraqi government. But that should be corrected quickly, correct?
One hopes. There will be, however, initially a vote in the House Tuesday night over whether or not to try to overrule the president's veto. This is gets into very arcane stuff, but it's a sign of how intense the feelings are running between the White House and Democrats now over procedural issues.
Well, the bill also contains an additional pay raise for the military, so
a good incentive to move it quickly.
Right. There are also ongoing investigations into the Justice Department over the firing of attorneys general, now into the CIA over the destruction of those videotapes.
Exactly. A lot of leftover investigations. We're even taking another look at steroids in baseball, a perennial favorite on Capitol Hill. But all of those are important issues. The contempt votes, for example, over the fired U.S. attorneys, that's how we started the last year in Congress.
Yeah, so it's a reminder that it's still there.
Exactly. Yeah. The other one that I think we need to think about is that terrorist surveillance bill. Remember, that is something that was exposed by the press back in 2006, and there was a lot of pressure to get the White House to talk to Congress about what exactly it was doing outside of the limits of existing law. Mm-hmm. And in the end, Congress ended up caving to the president and giving him the authority to do what he was doing already. That was back in August. But they said at the time, look, we haven't had a real debate on this. It'll sunset. That sunset is February 1st, and here we are back again at the same point.
This is the so-called FISA law.
Exactly.
And the White House has said that they want immunity for the telecommunication companies. Some have been cooperating with the White House in this surveillance. So what do you think is going to happen here?
I think you're going to see a blow-up in the Senate again. Republicans have already said, we are not going to give you any more time to do this. Harry Reid thinks he needs at least another month to complete it. Republicans won't give it to him. So they're kind of going to be in the same position they were back in August if they can't complete this, which is the law expires. If there is some sort of terrorist attack, the president and Republicans say it's the fault of the Democrats who deprived us of this key resource we need to keep Americans safe. It's again playing that fear of terrorism card that's been very effective in the past.
And it's there's politics there as well. And there may be, in the last issue we want to touch on, the one on everyone's mind, the weakening U.S. economy, there is talk of a stimulus package coming soon. But what are the politics here? Your thoughts?
Well, it's interesting because the Democrats are themselves split on this. Republicans have been holding to what we need is more tax cuts. Democrats are saying, yes, we need tax cuts, but we also may need a very strong spending package. What's interesting to me is that it's the presidential candidates now that are beginning to take over the initiative on this. Harry Reid, Senate Majority Leader, Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker, have asked the president to meet with them this week once he gets back from his Middle East trip to discuss this before he presents his own stimulus plan. They would like to see Democrats come together on this, but the Democratic candidates out on the stump are fighting among themselves over what is the most effective stimulus plan. That's going to be part of the presidential campaign. So I think what you'll also see is the beginning of the presidential campaign pretty much eclipsing what's going on in Capitol Hill.
Not just because of the conversation they're having, but because they're not in Washington. They're out on the campaign trail.
Gail Chadha, closer to the public.
Gail Chadha, Capitol Hill correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Thank you for that look ahead.
Thank you.
Well, two new polls out today show that Senator John McCain is surging ahead in the Republican race for president, Barack Obama gaining significant ground on Hillary Clinton on two issues, electability, and support from the African-American community. A Washington Post ABC News poll shows Obama holds a nearly 2-to-1 lead over Clinton among African-Americans. And a New York Times CBS poll shows that Democrats are much more convinced that the biracial Obama is electable. Meanwhile, the two campaigns have been sparring over the issue of race, each accusing the other of using it to win black voters in the run-up to the all-important Democratic primary in South Carolina, January 26th. Was this conversation inevitable? Is it a good thing for the country? Well, joining us to talk about that, Clarence Page, syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Welcome, as always, Clarence.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Melissa Harris-Lacewell, associate professor of politics and African-American studies at Princeton. She's writing a book on African-American women in politics. Professor, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you.
And I want to go to the polls first. You know, we'd been hearing the African-American community was torn. In fact, we've spoken with both of you about this. Many were longtime supporters of both the Clintons. Many African-Americans, we heard, were fearful that Obama wasn't electable, that whites who said they'd support him would not. And worse, there was fear that he'd be killed. Professor, let's start with you first. What do these new polls tell you?
Well, they tell me that African-Americans are complex voters, that we do not have any single monolithic viewpoint. But for the most part, they tell me that Hillary Clinton's early leads among African-American voters were probably due first to name recognition and then secondly to strategic voting. The sense of the inevitability of her campaign winning the nomination meant that many African-Americans wanted to, you know, back the winning horse. They wanted to support a ticket that could win, particularly in the general elections. Now that Iowa and New Hampshire have demonstrated two things. One, that white voters will in fact come out and support Barack Obama. That means that he's electable, which brings more African Americans into the coalition because they believe that it's a possibly winning coalition. The other thing is that increasingly, as language starts to come out from the Clinton campaign and the surrogates of the Clinton campaign that appear to be attacking Barack Obama based on race, that causes a kind of rallying effect for many African-American voters who originally thought maybe Barack Obama was not sort of interested in the cause of black people. But now that he is being, in fact, attacked around questions of race, they become more likely to support him.
Well, Professor Lacewell, we rush to say that you are a supporter of Barack Obama. In fact, you've written a piece in Slate.com entitled Rally for Him Now. We want to hear more from you on that. And you characterize these as attacks from the Clinton campaign on Obama.
Or from surrogates.
And you know that they would say that's not what they're doing. Clarence Page, you know, how is it being seen? Again, it's a complicated, not a monolith community, the African-American community. But are these being seen as attacks from the Clintons and their surrogates on Obama?
Well, I tend to look at it more from the traditional political point of view, first of all. And as we say in Chicago, politics ain't beanbag. Most folks I know have been waiting for the attacks to come, and it is a sign of Barack Obama's rising success. Ms. Harris-Lacewell is absolutely right about a lot of black voters holding back who didn't know Barack Obama, but everybody knows Hillary Clinton. I've heard more Democrats in Iowa, Illinois, South Carolina, up in New Hampshire say, gee, if I could only just take part of each of them and put them all together into one candidate.
Right, because, but is this sniping that we were talking about, you know, going to turn into cannibalism? You know, is the party in danger of destroying these top candidates? Let's take a
I'm
look.
I'm shocked at the notion of Democrats arguing with each other, right?
I mean, actually,
this has been quite civil when you look at what's going to happen, of course, when Democrats are fighting Republicans.
Well, so Clarence Page, you say quite civil. Professor Lacewell, you say attacks. Let's review as if people need it. I mean, I'm sure people are well aware of the conversation that's going on. Hillary Clinton last week said that Martin Luther King's dream needed to be implemented by a president, Lyndon Johnson. Many blacks interpreted that as meaning that, you know, she was dismissing MLK's role. She said on Tim Russert's Meet the Press that she only meant that you need a political partner, and further suggested that it was Obama's campaign that distorted her remarks. Barack Obama replied that that was ludicrous. Professor Lacewell, is that what you see as one of the attacks?
No. So again, what I'm suggesting is how African Americans are seeing this. So a lot of work I do is on how African Americans talk to each other in spaces that I call the black counterpublic, things
right.
like the black blog and barbershops and beauty salons and churches. What I'm trying to report to you is my sort of position as a public opinion researcher, that attacks is how African Americans are perceiving what is happening. In other words, so in this kind of black counterpublic, the language is that Hillary Clinton, the Clinton campaign, and the surrogates of the Clinton campaign are attacking Barack on race. All I'm suggesting is that in some ways, that actually is of benefit to Obama's campaign. It's of benefit to his campaign for two reasons. One, whoever the Democratic nominee is going to have to take lots of attacks from the Republican side. So the more that Clinton herself suggested we vet candidates through the fire of this process, the better it is for whomever becomes the nominee. The second reason that it is of benefit to Barack Obama is because there was a kind of media-generated anxiety about his racial authenticity that emerged earlier in the year, in 2007. And now, as race becomes sort of a way of framing and thinking about him from the outside, African-American voters become increasingly comfortable with his racial authenticity. This is a familiar ground for them to watch a black candidate walk.
Clarence Page, you've written about this. What happened to that debate? And we'll remind our listeners it was one of the most heated that we've had, an emotional response.
Whether Barack was black enough?
Whether he was black enough. I've heard reporters say even recently, and analysts, I've heard analysts say even recently, well, Barack Obama comes without the baggage of the civil rights era of the 60s. Some would say that's, you know, the insult there is that it's a badge of honor to have been in that.
In other words, is he black enough or too black,
And so Professor Lacewell saying that, maybe this helps that question in that he's perceived as being attacked for being black. Where do you think
what
this
really helps Barack Obama is people getting to know him. It's natural and sensible for black Americans to respond to question a guy they don't know. We know him in Illinois, but he was being questioned the same way. I can go back in the 90s as whether he was black enough in Chicago. Nobody asks that anymore. And I think this is what you're finding around the country. What's intriguing to me is look at the new questions that are being raised. Look at the attacks being raised against Hillary Clinton, criticizing her for the Martin Luther King remarks. Congressman Jim Clyburn from South Carolina, probably the most influential black voice in the state politically and senior black member of the House, he came out criticizing her remarks. And I watch him and I watch various other folks, and I sense that a lot of people are looking for ways to distinguish between Barack and Hillary Clinton. And are finding here a way to get out from under what they may see as a dilemma as Barack's popularity rises among black voters.
Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune. Melissa Harris-Lacewell is associate professor at Princeton. We mentioned surrogates. Here's Clinton supporter Bob Johnson of Black Entertainment Television introducing Hillary Clinton in South Carolina yesterday.
I am, frankly, insulted that the Obama campaign would imply that we are so stupid that we would think Hillary and Bill Clinton, who have been deeply and emotionally involved in black issues, and Barack Obama was doing something in the neighborhood that I won't say what he was doing, but he said it in the book.
Johnson said he was not referring to anything more than Obama's work in the neighborhoods. Clarence, you've told us that you say the only damage Bob Johnson did was to himself. But did he damage the Clinton campaign? We're going to have more on the impact of race in the presidential race when we come back after a one-minute break here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with Clarence Page, syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and Melissa Harris-Lacewell, associate professor of politics and African-American studies at Princeton. Professor Lacewell, what do you make of how Barack Obama himself is speaking about race? Both Hillary Clinton and Obama spoke in churches yesterday in the South, for instance. Clinton saying many of the parishioners were born before African-Americans could vote. Obama saying we're on the brink of history, but it's not racial history. It's a grassroots movement of people of all races. Your thoughts?
Well, for the most part, the Obama campaign has largely stayed away from specific conversations about race. So I'll give you an example. During the New Hampshire ABC debate, there was a moment where they were talking about change, and Hillary Clinton says, "I would be the first woman president. How's that for change?" And Barack Obama did not respond, "I'd be the first black president. How about that for change?" Right? Now, that said, no one is missing that there is a black guy standing there talking about slavery, talking about Selma, talking about the ways in which the American story is framed by the African-American story. So he's using it. When I think about race and Barack Obama, he has developed very nicely the secret handshake. It's the same secret handshake that George W. Bush uses effectively with the evangelical community, where he's able to communicate to voters that he is in solidarity with their goals without alienating other voters. Because, in fact, being in solidarity with black goals is not being alien from the goals of the American population. They go together.
But, Clarence, you've written a fascinating commentary in the Chicago Tribune entitled "Obama is an Escape from the Politics of Race," that there are those, especially on the right, who interpret his run as being just that person we were talking about, somebody who doesn't have the baggage of the civil rights era.
Yeah, that column was inspired by the outpouring of good words I was hearing from conservative voices, varying from David Brooks, whom I know well, and just thinks Obama is just sort of the model candidate, even if they don't agree on everything politically, to even Rush Limbaugh finding nice things to say about her, if only in comparison with Hillary Clinton.
In comparison with Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton and the old guard.
Well, that's the main thing. Yeah, George Will and Bill Bennett were just exuberant on Iowa caucus night that Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton might as well just pack up and head to a retirement village. And I wanted to point out that that's not the way it works, folks. Just like Professor Harris Leiswold said, people want to oversimplify black folks and say, obviously you only have one black leader at a time, so now that Barack Obama's rising, that means Al Sharpton is gone. And of course, conservatives are exuberant about that notion. We saw the same thing in Chicago, by the way, when Harold Washington was elected the first black mayor back in 83, and folks said, well, this is the end of Jesse Jackson, who, is a Chicagoan. Well, what happened that next year, 84, Jesse Jackson ran for president, that's not how it works, folks. But there is a good reason for people to celebrate the fact that, a diversity of black leadership is rising up. Obama is a post-civil rights generation guy. He is not out of the clergy. He's out of Harvard Law School. I mean, Americans on the whole, right and left, black, white, et cetera, are celebrating the obvious signs of progress, whether they're comfortable with all of Barack's politics or not.
Well, and Melissa Harris-Lacewell, I just want to ask you one last thing, because another side effect of this current conversation is that people like you, a black woman, find yourself debating a white woman that you might normally have been arm in arm with. I'm talking about Gloria Steinem. You mentioned to us that you've debated her. What was the context of that?
It was in relationship to the New York Times piece, op-ed piece, which she published just before the New Hampshire primaries, which posited this mythical black woman candidate who would be somehow equally as unqualified as Barack Obama in the sort of phrasing that she put forward. And so for me, as an African-American woman, there's no pull here in the sense of, should I go with my gender and support Hillary Clinton, or go with my race and support Barack Obama? That's just not how race and gender works. And by the way, I am the child of a mother who graduated from Brigham Young, so I could equally say I should go with Mitt Romney because he's Mormon. So that's a kind of flatness of understanding our identity.
But some people are pulled.
By those two questions. Actually, I think the issue is really thinking about how race and gender intersect. So what we see here is, for example, when Hillary Clinton wells up just before the New Hampshire primary and talks about the stress and strain of being on the campaign trail, that is simply something that is available to white women but not available to all women. It is hard for me to imagine that anyone in the American media would be sympathetic towards Condi Rice welling up about the stresses of her job. Now, I am no Condi Rice fan, but I do know that she has certain restrictions on her, as an African American woman in the positions of power that she's in.
I don't know. I have to disagree with you. I'm not sure that it was the media that was sympathetic to Hillary Clinton after she welled up.
Yes.
You think it was?
No. I think that it was clearly about voters who saw her and saw in her something that reminded them of themselves. And part of what race does in America is make it very difficult for us to see each other across difference. Mm-hmm. Barack Obama is asking people who are mostly not like him to look at him and see him as familiar. And because we are in a country where race is such a strong dividing line between our capacity to see each other as similar, I think that it's particularly hard for Barack Obama to do that work. White women actually have not lived in segregated environments far away from structures of power. They have been subjugated under that power, but they've also been sitting in the White House since the White House opened.
Well, I'm going to give you each a last thought. Melissa Harris-Lacewell, this conversation, ultimately good for African Americans?
I think it's just good for the country. I think any time we have a democratic system where we have an open seat race on both sides, I think that is only good for the democratic system.
And Clarence Page, is it good for the Democratic Party?
Well, like I said, they have an embarrassment of riches right now compared to the Republicans. I think Democrats are in a better situation this year.
Clarence Page, syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Melissa Harris-Lacewell, associate professor of politics and African-American studies at Princeton. A conversation we've had before and will continue. So thank you both.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, an abortion doctor tells her story, including mistakes she made and women she turned away for fear they were making a mistake. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, turning panhandler signs into art. Back after the news, Here and Now. Who's ahead in the Democratic race for president? Well, it depends. Hillary Clinton won the New Hampshire primary by nearly 9,000 votes over Barack Obama. But in what many say is the real contest, they tied. Well, actually, Obama won, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. Welcome to the Democratic Party nominating process. Jim Roosevelt is co-chair of the Democratic National Committee's Rules and Bylaws Committee. He joins us now. Jim, welcome.
Hello. Glad to be with you.
Well, your party has state delegates, and then there are superdelegates. Let's start with the state delegates. How are they apportioned to candidates?
The state delegates, first of all, are allocated to the states by a formula that takes into account Democratic voting strength in each state.
Mm-hmm.
Then they are allocated to congressional districts within the state, so that when you look at the number of delegates won in a particular state, you can't just take the statewide vote totals and translate them directly. You have to actually, to get an accurate count, break it down district by district within the state.
Okay, and we understand that after New Hampshire, both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton received 9 delegates apiece. John Edwards received 4. Then, so that's the tie, even though Hillary Clinton beat Barack Obama in the popular vote by about 8,000 votes, or 3%. But then we understand that when you add in the superdelegates, Barack Obama pulls ahead. Now, what are superdelegates?
Superdelegates are full delegates to the convention, same vote as the state delegates in the convention. They are basically party leaders and elected officials, and they're provided for in the charter and the delegate selection rules of the Democratic Party nationally. And it includes the Democratic National Committee members, the Democratic members of Congress from that state, and some of the Democratic statewide office holders.
It's the members of the hierarchy, if you will. It's the movers and shakers. It's people like you.
It's some of the people who are very active in the party, and some of the people who were elected by the voters to public office.
Right, and that's why when Massachusetts Senator John Kerry, for instance, threw his support to Barack Obama last Thursday at an Obama rally, it was more than just the former candidate for president throwing his support. John Kerry is a superdelegate.
It actually guarantees, at a minimum, one more convention delegate for Barack Obama.
So the superdelegates is what pushes Barack Obama ahead after New Hampshire, because we understand he received 3 superdelegates commitment to Hillary Clinton's 2. So even though they were tied in the popular vote, he edges ahead because of the superdelegates.
Right.
But tell us more about superdelegates. They don't have to commit, but they do.
Superdelegates do commit, but exactly when is up to them, any time between the beginning of the year and the convention.
Well, how did this system come about, Jim?
starting back in 1972, the Democratic Party really reorganized how it selected convention delegates. This grew out of the 1968 experience, which was really the last of the old-style conventions where politicians and political leaders in the back rooms.
Party bosses, yeah.
That's right, had decided who many of the convention delegates would be. Unhappiness over that process led to a commission chaired by George McGovern that produced a method that made the primaries and the caucuses the principal determinants of who would be the delegates. That led, of course, to George McGovern's nomination for president in 1972.
And he suffered a terrible defeat, so the pendulum swung back a little bit to bring a little more of the party leadership in?
That's correct. There was a feeling then that there needed to be more connection to the elected officials and the party leaders of the states to prevent these great pendulum swings.
Hence the superdelegate added in 1996.
That's correct.
And some are saying that that process of the superdelegate is undemocratic because somebody who's been in the party a long time and been a long time operative, like a Clinton, would probably have more favors, you know, to call in from some of the superdelegates. That it's really not a grassroots way of electing someone.
The balance between the votes of the moment and the people who have been elected as Democratic office holders or elected as party officials is always one that's open to debate. Right now, we think we have a method that keeps the elected officials and the party activists involved and hears their voice while giving the greatest weight to the votes in the primaries and caucuses.
Well, that brings us to Michigan. Tomorrow, they hold their presidential primary for Democrats. But because Michigan defied the party and moved its primary up, the DNC has said that Michigan's delegates won't count come convention time in August. And they also asked the candidates not to compete there. Now, Obama and Edwards did pull their names off the ballot. Clinton left her name on the ballot but says she won't campaign. What happens to those delegates? Is it really possible that they're not going to count?
Because the Michigan state government decided to hold a primary outside the rules of either party, Democratic or Republican, both parties have penalized them in delegates. The Democratic Party took away 100% of their delegates under its rules, and the Republican Party took away 50% of their delegates. So what's taking place there is really a state-financed public opinion poll that will not select delegates. What happens as we get closer to the convention remains to be seen. I don't think you will see delegates counted from Michigan as long as the contest for the presidential nomination is still an open question.
Really? I mean, you know, there may be a messy little crowd of angry Michigan Democrats come August.
What has always happened in the past is that states whose legislatures decided to hold a process outside the rules of the party have had the party organizations in those states conduct caucuses that do comply with the rules. Now, so far, Michigan and Florida have not agreed to do that. We'll wait and see what happens as we get to the period, which begins February 5, when the rules do provide for those states to hold their own caucuses.
And, Jim, finally, except for a handful of states, the Republicans operate by a winner-take-all system. In other words, whoever wins the primary gets all the delegates. John McCain won the popular vote in New Hampshire. He got all the states' 7 delegates.
Republicans do use a winner-take-all system in almost every state. Democrats do use a system which apportions delegates by congressional district, which Democrats think is more representative. Republicans would undoubtedly argue the other way.
But both have uncommitted delegates. In other words, the superdelegates are often uncommitted, and Republicans have about, I think, 463 uncommitted delegates who can act the way superdelegates do.
Yes, Republicans also have a significant number of uncommitted delegates who make up their own minds apart from the primaries and the caucuses. Both parties feel that it's important that the people who represent the party either in elected office or in party activism also have a voice in this process.
Jim Roosevelt, co-chair of the Democratic National Committee's Rules and Bylaws Committee. He is also head of the party's Credentials Committee. Jim, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks very much. I've enjoyed being with you, Robin.
I think we explained that. Now, a heads up on some of the stories we're going to be following later this week. We're going to take a look at a proposal to build a 30,000-square-mile field of solar panels to power the country. Also, political cartoonist Jules Pfeiffer will be here and film director John Sayles. That's all this week. You're listening to Here and Now. If you live in an urban area, you've probably seen them at busy intersections trying to get your attention. Panhandlers with handwritten cardboard signs asking for help. Chances are you may have looked the other way on occasion. Well, now a public art project in Minneapolis is linking up artists with homeless people to redesign those signs and maybe hold your attention. Larissa Anderson is with Minnesota Public Radio. She'll explain.
David Drew's been panhandling or signing on and off for the last year. One of his signs caught the eye of Michael Allen, the photojournalist behind the public art project at the Minneapolis Public Library. It was a
10x10 piece of cardboard. Oh, it's still smudged. He's outlined it in color, and it says, "The IRS took my jet!" Exclamation point. Yacht is next. Please help. And he's got little waves underneath the word yacht.
I was tired of the same old homeless whatever and kind of tired of people's reaction to it.
That's David Drew.
So that's when I started kind of a series of comic relief, I kind of called them, with the IRS one, and they were wildly successful.
He's pulling people in. He's using humor.
Barbara Belknap is the graphic artist who redesigned David's sign.
David is using a lot of the tools of marketing and even target marketing.
Barbara says that's partly because David used the IRS sign in April.
It was timely because it was during tax season. That was top of mind to his regular customers, the people who came to his regular corner.
David's sign also had a flip side, which helped him reach a wider audience.
The backside of the sign said, "Homeless, please help." So he had a straight version and a funny version. So depending on who drove up, he would use the side of the sign that he thought would get more attention.
But Barbara says there's something else about David's sign that really worked.
I think one thing that David does very effectively is he breaks through the fear. Often people are afraid. They see a homeless person. They're not really sure what's going to happen once that person gets close to their car. By using humor or by breaking down those barriers, I think he's effectively getting closer to people.
In her version of David's cardboard sign, the part about the IRS took my jet is an elegant, scripty, scrolly font. There's blue sky in the background, and it's framed in gold. Barbara says even though they may look different, her sign has a lot in common with David's.
Well, my sign borrows very much from advertising, from slickness, from the sort of keep up with the Joneses, and so does his. He's talking about his yacht and his jet. I just made it look very, very slick. I wanted it to look like an American Express or a Lexus ad.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
David says he's had a lot of success with his funny signs. And success for him isn't just about how much change he can pocket.
Even if I get a laugh or a smile out of somebody, it's an acknowledgement that I'm out there. And that, to me, is as important as getting a dollar or getting 50 cents. So I started tailoring signs to get that response, a smile or a wave.
Like the sign he made that said,
"Alien mothership left me stranded, need money for a spaceship."
Or this other idea he had for a sign that was
just a simple checklist of things you can do to ignore me. Check your seatbelt, check your stereo, wash your windshield, call someone on your cell phone.
But David says his funny signs were so popular, they caught the attention of the cops, who eventually took his signs away.
So I've kind of gone back to the standard, you know, one-line deals because after losing a series of different signs to the police, I got to the point where I just grab a hunk of cardboard and a marker and go with that.
So now he's standing on the corner of 46th Street and 35W in Minneapolis, holding a sign with simple block letters.
Homeless, hungry, anything appreciated.
A string of cars wait at the red light. One woman hands David a couple dollars and a bag of potato chips. The guy two lanes over sticks his head out the window and yells, "Get a job."
Did you get that? I hope the microphone picked up that "get a job" yelled. Some days you're out here in the rain and you're miserable and you wouldn't, you know, the 10th "get a job" is just more than you can take. And it gets hard.
But for the most part, David says the people on the road have been good to him. He says 90% of the support he's gotten over the last year has been from signing. Those donations range from spare dollars to Starbucks gift cards.
As a matter of fact, the last time I came out here, I came home with like three bags of all things I'd eat, too, like peanut butter, jelly, bread. It was just like, wow. I mean, I actually just finished off the last of that peanut butter this morning.
David says there's a debate on the street about whether a well-made sign can bring in the bucks.
I had a guy tell me I made $35 with a blank piece of cardboard, and I thought, wow, does it matter what's written on there? And I think it does. I think people do actually take the time to read them for the most part.
Panhandler David Drew in Minneapolis. Larissa Anderson of Minneapolis Public Radio produced our story. Well, coming up, the art of the film score. Back in 1 minute with that, here and now. Next week, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences will announce its Oscar nominations, and we'll be paying close attention to one of our favorite categories, film scores. Dan Carlin is in the business of conducting film scores. Here's his work on Last of the Mohicans, composed by Trevor Jones and Randy Edelman. Well, now, Dan Carlin teaches about film scores as chair of the Berklee College of Music's film scoring department, and he joins us to talk about what makes a good film score good. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Your dad is Dan Carlin Sr. He was music editor on a lot of films, notably Dead Poets Society and Fatal Attraction. What did you learn from him, first of all?
Just about everything. My father was trying to get me in the business for a long time. I wanted to save the world, as everyone else did in the 70s. And when I wasn't able to do that, I joined him. And he taught me and my siblings and our cousins and the neighbor. And he's quite well known and respected in Los Angeles.
Well, and you know, sometimes a film score can almost save the world. It can certainly make you feel better, because we're big fans here. And we hear that your favorite of all time is also one of ours, Ennio Morricone.
Oh, my goodness, yes. And, you know, I've only worked with him once, but I did not get to work with him on the film that we all would have given a right arm to do, and that was The Mission, which is just an extraordinarily beautiful score.
There's that one incredible scene, priests with indigenous people leaving their monastery, being mowed down by, I believe, Spanish soldiers.
Right.
And, you know, it's a scene of carnage and chaos, but instead of a huge bombastic score, the screen goes absolutely silent except for the score. But whose idea is that?
Typically, the director would have that vision. But oftentimes, maybe the music editor and the film editor and the sound designer and the people on the dubbing stage, which is where they mix all these sounds together, they'll experiment with ideas like this.
I think it's one of the most powerful moments in film, and all there is the score.
Yeah. And this is what makes Morricone a great composer. He understands that it isn't about the music. It's always about the film, and the music cannot draw attention to itself. It has to enhance what's going on dramatically in the film.
Well, let's talk about one of the tracks that you were involved in. I mentioned it, the 1992 film adaptation of James Fenimore Cooper's classic Last of the Mohicans, Michael Mann directing. Set up this scene for us as we listen.
We're at the fort that is under siege. Daniel Day-Lewis's character and Madeline Stowe's character are in the fort. The relationship has a sexual tension that's built up all to this point. They've not even kissed. But tonight it looks like maybe the last night everyone will live, because it appears that the French will defeat them. So they are now looking for each other, wandering through the fort, and you hear a Scottish reel being played, and you see people dancing to it.
We understand this is the source music.
Well, right. There are only two types of music, really, ultimately, in films. Source music. And that's what the characters would hear, whether it's a jukebox or a person singing a song at a bar or something.
So the source is the Scottish
group. Yeah, there's a visual source of something, and then, or underscore. And that's the, I think, John Williams kind of music that enhances the scene. What we have here is now a combination, because it starts off with this Scottish reel. Then when they find each other, they walk away for their love scene. As that's going on, you're hearing more score. It's overlapping the source music very effectively. It's all in the same key. Trevor designed it that way. And then as their relationship takes focus, the source music goes away. The rest of the fort sounds go away, and it's just this romantic melody for them that ends. We don't see the lovemaking scene, but we go to a time change when they're embracing each other at the end.
Well, and shortly after that, of course, we must note that Daniel Day-Lewis utters the line, "I will find you."
Yes.
One of our favorites.
Don't give up.
Right. And speaking of over the top.
Well, that's all right.
Right. Well, you have a couple of examples that we were surprised. We thought, well, this will be interesting. You asked us to get some music for you that you could talk about. Celine Dion. Here is her singing for the character Lady Juliana from the 1998 animated feature Quest for Camelot. Let's listen to her film version.
Every every child knows. Lead her to a place. Guide her to a place. Give her faith so she'll be
saved. Now, this is where a true fan of film scores might say, no, this is not film score, this is pop music. You know, this is trying to sell a pop record through a film score. But you say what about the use of this song in this film?
Well, this song was written by David Foster and Carol Bayer Sager specifically for this scene. And it's an animated film, and this is a scene in which a mother has watched her daughter escape as the mother was captured by the bad guys.
Oh, yes.
And it's her job to go find Excalibur. And so now she offers this prayer that her journey is safe, that she accomplishes everything and is not harmed, and that she returns to her mother's arms. And so it's a very, very touching moment.
And does what for the film? I mean, inserting a song is almost like cheating. Does the film not tell the story well enough at that point? Do you think the song does it better?
Well, your choice is to have the mother talk to somebody about her concern about her daughter, or she can get down on her knees and say a prayer. But what we do is we show action. We see the daughter riding off on the horse. We see the mother being captured. All this is going on while we're hearing this song. And it's just a way of artistically delivering the same message, but now you have a new medium, the song.
Dan Carlin, again, new chair of the Berklee College of Music's film scoring department, talking about some songs that have been important parts of film scores. But I'm wondering, you know, also on our favorite list, Lawrence of Arabia from Maurice Jarre, anything from Bernard Herrmann or Jerry Goldsmith or Elmer Bernstein, or, as you know, we were saying, Ennio Morricone, anything.
Yeah.
Lalo Schifrin. I mean, I'm thinking all of these wonderful film masters. Is that style, that underscoring orchestral sound, is that sort of being pushed aside by get a pop song in the score?
It's more the style of the movies, I think, that command a different approach. You mentioned a couple of people there that I've worked with, Lalo Schifrin and Elmer Bernstein. Several of these people, like John Williams, for instance. John Williams started as a jazz piano player. He was Henry Mancini's piano player on the Peter Gunn theme, a very famous theme, before he took off. I loved what John Williams did for Schindler's List. I hear that melody played by that violin, and it just, you know, it's goosebumps and tears, and I'm amazed that someone can write something like Star Wars and Superman and then turn around and just rip your heart out with a beautiful theme about such a torturous time in human history.
Dan Carlin, new chair of the Berklee College of Music Film Scoring Department. For more, go to our website, here-now.org, and we will leave you with the music of John Williams in Schindler's List. Dan, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.